from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraqi and Kurdish officials say fighters have retaken part of the Mosul Dam. An analyst offers his solution to the crisis in Iraq.
That's probably the best way to move, rather than to begin to put boots on the ground, because that is not going to be seen as part of the solution, but as a part of the problem.
Australia offers to resettle thousands of Iraqi and Syrian refugees. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Iraqi and Kurdish officials say Kurdish Peshmerga fighters have retaken part of the Mosul Dam from the control of Islamic State militants. Arab reporters in the area say fighting is ongoing and U.S. planes have been bombing militant positions. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Arab satellite channels showed video of black smoke billowing into the air after U.S. aircraft conducted bombing raids around the Mosul Dam Monday. Sky News Arabia reported U.S. airstrikes were continuing and Peshmerga fighters had recaptured parts of the dam in addition to the town of Tel Khif. Iraqi military spokesman General Qasem Mohammed Atta told Iraqi TV the operation to dislodge Islamic State militants from the dam is succeeding. He says ground forces recaptured the body of the dam and other installations at the Mosul Dam before midday with support from the air by government planes and U.S. aircraft. He said Peshmerga fighters were working to clean up areas still controlled by the militants and to remove explosive devices. Al Arabiya TV quoted an Islamic State spokesman who said his group had made a tactical withdrawal from around the dam and other parts of Nineveh province. The TV channel also reported U.S. planes had destroyed more than a dozen tanks, Humvees, and armored personnel carriers used by the militant group. Atta claimed government forces, of which the Kurdish Peshmerga are a component, are in the process of working to roll back the militants and would soon launch an attack to try to retake the city of Mosul. Amateur video showed Peshmerga fighters battling Islamic State militants with automatic weapons along a front line between the autonomous Kurdish region and Nineveh province. Mosul fell to the militant group on June 10th after Iraqi government forces pulled out. Horrific videos of Iraqi soldiers being executed and reports of other brutality by the militants have outraged world public opinion. A recent campaign of ethnic cleansing against Christians and members of the Yazidi minority has added to the outrage. A member of parliament from Iraq's Turkmen minority called on the United Nations and the world community to intervene to protect Turkmen in the region of Tuz Kharmatu from being harmed by Islamic State militants. He said many Turkmen have been under siege for more than 2 months. British Defense Minister Michael Fallon was reported to have told a gathering of military personnel the battle against Islamic State militants would likely take weeks and months and would no longer be just a humanitarian operation. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United States has expanded its targeted airstrikes aimed at Islamic State militants in northern Iraq. President Barack Obama Sunday sent a letter to congressional leaders announcing his authorization of targeted airstrikes to support Iraqi forces in their effort to recapture the Mosul Dam, referring to it as a critical infrastructure site. Mr. Obama warned failure of the dam could threaten the lives of large numbers of civilians, endanger U.S. personnel and facilities, including the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and prevent the Iraqi government from providing critical services to its people. A National Security Council spokeswoman said the operations are limited in nature, duration, and scope. She said they are being undertaken in coordination with and at the request of the Iraqi government. The United States first launched airstrikes earlier this month against the insurgents, in part to prevent the killing of thousands of Yazidis stranded on Mount Sinjar in northern Iraq. RAND Corporation senior political scientist and former U.S. Army officer Rick Brennan says the latest airstrikes are the beginnings of what he calls a more reasoned involvement in Iraq.
The early argument that the president was making and the administration was making about the humanitarian issue and the limited attacks assistance we'd be giving, I think, was unrealistic given the type of assistance that the Iraqis need. And so at this point in time, what the Iraqis need is assistance in trying to help do the operational planning and the integration of air and ground capabilities to try to move back ISIL. We need a strategic approach for how we're going to engage, how our Western allies will engage, as well as the nations in the region will engage to turn back ISIL.
Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Mike Rogers, warned of the continued danger posed by the Sunni militant group.
ISIL now is a terrorist organization with an army. That's what makes them so dangerous. Tanks, helicopters, heavy artillery, money, all of those equate to a pretty dangerous situation.
Rogers says, however, Kurdish ground forces, now better armed, are regaining lost ground. For some perspective on U.S. involvement in northern Iraq, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two scholars, Edmund Gharib, professor at American University here in Washington, and Faisal Itani, resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. First, Edmund Gharib.
This is something that's very complex. On the one hand, President Obama was very careful about sending military support to the Iraqi government. And part of the reason why I think he did that was primarily because he wanted to put pressure on Prime Minister Maliki to either change his policies and the direction in which he was taking Iraq, but also to perhaps put pressure so that others would also come to the decision that maybe it's time for Mr. Maliki to leave the scene as Prime Minister of Iraq. Nevertheless, this creates a lot of problems. First, on the American level, President Obama was the president who was elected to a large extent because he promised to get the American forces out of Iraq, because he argued the decision to go to war was a wrong decision. This is also a slippery slope, whereby you begin to send forces. Yes, this was a humanitarian crisis. There was a failure on the part of the various powerful forces on the ground to move to help the Yazidis and the Christians and others. But at the same time, there is a need to confront this extremist organization. But I think probably the best way would be first to get the Iraqis themselves, to provide them with the support, to get a government of national unity, a government that's going to represent all Iraqis, and a government that's going to look at this threat as a threat to all Iraqis, provide them with military, diplomatic support is probably the best way, and also get the United Nations in. That's probably the best way to move, rather than to begin to put boots on the ground, because that is not going to be seen as part of the solution, but as a part of the problem.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, for your assessment of the U.S. role so far, the airstrikes, the support particularly to the Peshmerga forces as well as to Baghdad, that's certainly not nearly enough. But how do you see the U.S. role going forward?
Let me take a slightly different angle on how I see the motivations and the trajectory of the policy. I think the humanitarian aspect was not non-existent, but a secondary factor in the decision to intervene to the extent to which the United States has. I believe this was a gradual realization that the ISIS problem and their military momentum had gotten out of hand, and that something needed to be done to shore up the Kurdish position and, if you will, contain the Islamic State, not defeat it. There was, of course, the benefit that beleaguered refugees were rescued, but if that were the criteria for U.S. action, then I would indeed be worried about a slippery slope, because there are so many people in grave danger in both Iraq and Syria. I think President Obama has been extremely disciplined about it. I don't think this will turn into the sort of broad humanitarian intervention. If it hasn't already over the past 3 years, I don't think it will do so now. I think the policy will continue to be one of containment while Iraq gets its house in order, if indeed it does. The president's view is that taking it much further beyond that is probably an overly ambitious policy, given the realities on the ground. The problem is this indicates a real mismatch of ambition between the Islamic State and what they're trying to achieve and what the United States is willing and able to do as the president sees it. ISIS can live with a containment strategy. They're a state-building organization before anything else. And as long as they're able to consolidate control of territory, resources, and protect their lines of communication, they're perfectly happy for the situation to stay as it is in Iraq. Indeed, they are actually expanding westwards into Syria and making dramatic gains there.
Faisal Attani is resident fellow at the Atlantic Council Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. He and Edmund Garib Mustafa Brazani, scholar for Global Kurdish Studies at American University, spoke with VOA's Carol Castiel, host of the program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation at our website, voanews.com. Just look for Encounter under the Programs tab. Australia's Immigration Minister Scott Morrison says the country will offer to resettle almost 4,500 refugees from Iraq and Syria. This will be part of Canberra's formal refugee intake of about 14,000 people each year. Morrison insists the places are available because of the government's success in stopping asylum seeker boats. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Iraqi Christians and others from the Yazidi faith will be eligible for special humanitarian visas in Australia. Canberra has set aside 2,200 places for refugees fleeing violence in Iraq and a similar number from Syria. Applicants will have to undergo standard health, security and identity checks before resettlement. Immigration Minister Scott Morrison says that tough border control measures are allowing Australia to offer refuge to some of those displaced by fighting in the Middle East. The government in Canberra has deployed the Navy to intercept vessels carrying asylum seekers and is refusing resettlement to anyone arriving on unauthorised boats. Boat arrivals are being transferred to Australian-sponsored camps on the tiny South Pacific Republic of Nauru and Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. But Ian Rintoul from advocacy group the Refugee Action Coalition says the government's offer to resettle Christians and other ethnic and religious minorities from Iraq and Syria is confusing, coming while the asylum claims of other Iraqis are still to be assessed.
There's an immediate contradiction with the government's attitude, and that is that they've got 700-800 people from Iraq who are either in detention centres living in limbo in the community or in offshore detention centres like Nauru and Manus Island that they're not proposing to do anything about. They've denied even people, Iraqi people who arrive by boat, the right to family reunion. So it's an extremely selective offer when there are already so many people in the community or in detention in Australia that the government's doing nothing about.
Last year, Australia granted humanitarian visas to more than 1,000 people from Syria, more than 2,000 from Iraq, and almost 3,000 from Afghanistan. Refugee campaigners say Australia's commitment to global resettlement programs has slipped into reverse since the Conservative government took office in September last year, cutting the overall refugee intake from 20,000 to under 14,000. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Berlin and Moscow say some progress was made in talks among the foreign ministers of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. But Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says there has been no headway in reaching the main goal, ending the unrest in eastern Ukraine. Lisa Bryant has details from Paris.
Speaking Monday from Berlin, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said talks the previous evening had resolved all questions about humanitarian aid to Ukraine.
Где у нас пока нет возможности доложить какие-то позитивные результаты.
But Lavrov said the Berlin meeting with his counterparts from Ukraine, Germany, and France had made no progress when it came to reaching a ceasefire and a political solution in eastern Ukraine. The meeting of the four foreign ministers stretched into late Sunday night. Speaking to reporters afterwards, German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier said it is critical to silence the guns in Ukraine and avoid more victims.
Ein schwieriges Gespräch, aber ich glaube und ich hoffe, dass wir in einzelnen Punkten.
Steinmeier said that while the talks were difficult, he hoped some progress had been achieved. The four foreign ministers were to report back to their capitals and look for ways to continue the discussions. A rest a few days formed the backdrop to the talks. Ukrainian forces said they had advanced into the key rebel-controlled city of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. The Ukrainian military also said separatists had shot down a government fighter jet, but the pilot had safely ejected. Meanwhile, trucks from a disputed Russian convoy said to contain humanitarian aid had arrived at a border point controlled by Ukrainian separatists. The Red Cross is to oversee delivery of the supplies. Moscow denies the trucks carry military material for the rebels, saying the convoy only carries humanitarian goods. Moscow also denied claims by Ukrainian separatists that they had received a large shipment of weapons and armored vehicles. The European Union and the United States have imposed sanctions against Russia over its role in the Ukraine conflict. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Things could be looking up for Nigeria. Nearly a month after an Ebola-infected air traveler from Liberia brought the disease to Lagos. Four people have since died of the virus there, but the health ministry said today that five others have now completely recovered. There has been a total of 12 confirmed cases. Public health experts say Nigeria has acted fast to contain the situation, but the country cannot let down its guard. VOA's Anne Look has more on the story from Dakar.
It looked to be a typical Sunday at the St. Peter's Catholic Church in Ole, Nigeria. But there was something different this week. Church member Simeon Uzi.
For now, we'll just say the peace of the Lord be with you and also with you. We'll just look at each other, but no handshake, just to prevent the spread of the disease.
He's talking about Ebola. Ebola can be spread through contact with a sick person's bodily fluids. Governments around the region are advising people not to shake hands or hug. Uzi says he's not taking any chances, not even at church. Public health experts say this is no time for Nigeria to get complacent. Nearly 200 people there are still under surveillance. Authorities believe they have found everyone who may have been exposed to Ebola since that infected air traveler arrived in Lagos on July 20th. The leader of the U.S. Center for Disease Control's team in Lagos, John Vertafoye, says Nigeria has, quote, hit a stable period.
We've benefited from being able to trace every case that's come in so far to that initial index case. We are using this period for preparedness. Preparedness in case things did take a turn for the worse to make sure that the teams are in place to respond accordingly.
He said the contact tracing team is more than doubling this week to 200 people. Suspected Ebola patients have been moved to a new clinical ward in Lagos. It has 40 beds, more than enough for the current caseload. But the government has plans to expand it even further, just in case. The regional outbreak is far from over. Experts say Nigeria should focus in particular on public education. There's an Ebola hotline. The government is using Facebook and other media to get the word out. But misinformation continues. Text messages have been going around advertising false cures, like drinking or bathing in salt water. Dr. Chikwe Hikwezu is an infectious disease expert who runs the website Nigeria Health Watch.
These rumors need to be rebutted firmly and quickly, and they need to be in our faces. And I think they're not doing enough of it. Some of it has started happening, but at the moment it feels like the rumors are two, three steps ahead of us, and it takes 3-4 days for the government to respond to any of these.
Nigeria is Africa's most populous country, with more than 150 people. It's also the biggest economy in the region. The outbreak currently raging in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea is already unprecedented and out of control. Public health experts shudder to think what a large-scale outbreak in Nigeria could mean. Lagos alone is a densely populated city of some 20 million people, where experts say the virus could spread rapidly, if given the chance. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
On the final day of his 5-day visit to South Korea today, Pope Francis called for the reconciliation of the Korean family.
Preghiamo dunque per il sorgere di nuove opportunità di dialogo.
The Pontiff said, let us pray for the emergence of new opportunities for dialogue and the resolution of differences, for continued generosity in providing humanitarian assistance to those in need, and for an even greater recognition that all Koreans are brothers and sisters, members of one family, one people. The pontiff ended his five-day visit, the first for a pope in 15 years, with a mass at Seoul's main cathedral, attended by President Park Geun-hye. Robert Kelly, an associate professor at Pusan University, told VOA's Victor Beatty, the pope was generally well-received, but the appeal for reconciliation will likely fall on deaf ears in Pyongyang.
The North is not going to listen. The North doesn't listen to the Chinese or the Americans or the South Koreans. They're not going to listen to the papacy. North Korea also doesn't have many Catholics. So, you know, I think he emphasized a couple of things that are important in Korea, such as taking care of the poor and less materialism. Korea is sort of a pretty materialist, consumerist kind of place. So I thought the Pope's message on that was pretty good. South Korea doesn't have a really big Catholic population. It's only about 10%. So it's not like there were huge numbers of people pouring out to see him. And there were big numbers, but I mean, it wasn't like going to Brazil or something like that, right? And I mean, I guess the only downside, I guess, would be is that Protestant groups in Korea took it very badly, which kind of surprised me, actually. But there were like Protestant protests. Sort of, there's a lot of sort of writing in Korean newspapers about sort of like now like an incipient competition between Protestant churches and the Catholic Church and stuff like that. I don't really know how much that is real or not, but there was a fair amount of that.
Is there a sense that the church, the Catholic Church, is pivoting toward Asia, much like the U.S. is politically?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I'm not really sure if the Catholic Church is ever going to make deep inroads. Christianity, generally, I'm not sure ever going to make deep inroads in Asia. My own sense is that Asian religious traditions are actually, one, pretty well-rooted. We don't talk about them too much, but I think they are. And two, they're so distinct from the kind of monotheism of Christianity and Islam and stuff like that in the West that I think those religions will have trouble really making deep inroads here. Remember, only 20% of Koreans are Christian, 22% or something like that. It's really not a big number. And, you know, it's very low in Japan. It's very low in China. So I'm not really sure if there's a pivot, but certainly, you know, if I was the church and I was sort of looking around for like where you can go, where can you expand if you're in decline in the West? I mean, Asia's a place to go. Asia's wealthy enough that people might be considering shifting. Christianity in Asia has kind of like a Western kind of like modernizing sheen to it. It looks kind of like cool and chic and futurish as opposed to sort of traditional Buddhist and Confucian beliefs. So there's always been kind of like a modernizing sheen, particularly to the Catholic Church in Korea.
Robert, understand earlier before he left today, he received a butterfly pin from one of the elderly comfort women who attended his mass. Was that issue ever raised?
Yeah, it was. And I'm not, again, I have to admit, I'm a little bit wary about bringing that kind of stuff up with the Pope. I mean, the Catholic Church didn't really play any kind of meaningful role at all in that. It's not like the debate, you know, the sort of nasty debate in the West about what was the church's role during the Holocaust and should have done more and things like that. I mean, when it comes to the comfort women, the Catholic Church just really wasn't a part of that at all. That's really between the Koreans and the Japanese and the Chinese to a certain extent. But it's such an emotional issue in Korea that, you know, almost everything of any kind of big geopolitical or social importance in Korea kind of gets pushed through that filter. I mean, to a certain extent, I think it's a way of sort of trying to recruit the moral authority of the church to press the Japanese to come around on this issue. You know, I don't know if that's a good idea. My own sense is probably not, but I understand why the Koreans did it. It's really big, and the Koreans want to push the Japanese. And if they can get the Pope to say something on that, it's another sort of point of leverage.
Interestingly, as the Pope was preaching reconciliation between the Koreas, joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises got underway for the next week or so. Is that causing any concern in South Korea, given the North's threatened retaliation?
Well, Ulchi is a regular thing, right? I mean, we do this every year, and so I'm not entirely sure if the North is going to do anything they haven't done before. I'm sure they'll shoot off some rockets, or they'll say something about, you know, dropping a bomb on the Blue House or the White House or something like that. I'm not really sure. I think South Koreans have kind of tuned out a lot of that stuff. North Korea really has to go over the top now to get South Koreans' anxieties up. What was a little bit more noticeable, maybe rather than Ulchi, was the North Korean decision to fire off rockets an hour before the Pope got off the plane in Seoul. That struck me as really, really poor timing, and it was a really, really obvious, direct sort of way by the North to say that, you know, we don't want any more intervention in South Korean or in Korean affairs and that, you know, foreigners like the Pope should stay out. That was a really, really strong signal and in pretty poor taste, in my opinion.
Robert Kelly, an associate professor at Pusan University. The annual U.S.-South Korean military exercises, known as Ulchi Freedom Guardian, involve tens of thousands of troops and are described as routine and defensive. However, a spokesman for the Korean Army General Staff warned a, quote, most powerful and advanced, merciless preemptive strike will start anytime chosen by us, end quote. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.